welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And I think I forgot yesterday to help emphasize the importance in supporting Jerry Winstrand in his campaign in Missouri. Please make sure you take the time. If you're meaning to do it, please do it as soon as possible and as often as possible. I know everybody is feeling the pinch. As a matter of fact, there's no doubt in my mind the Democrats are literally running around trying to create leverage on the economic impacts that are occurring under Republican tenure. So any and all help, especially for a champion of the Constitution, if I haven't impressed upon you to do that, please, please, what you can do, what help you can provide would be greatly appreciated. So anyway, we are interestingly going through the nitinoid details of the Federalist Papers. And the only way to do it is by reading it line for line and identifying every little thing that basically stands out. I mean, even though it may be in a very what's the best word for it? Because it's sophistry. It is deception, where Hamilton kind of throws out these arguments like he did that the court should be involved in, you know, things that concern other citizens. In anything that the United States does in concerning citizens, it opens the door to a whole gamut of crap. Now, it's one thing because the language in the Constitution was out there regarding a citizen filing a case against a state. And that's in the jurisdiction, which was taken out from the 11th Amendment. So, in other words, if a foreign citizen has a problem with the state of California, it doesn't jump into a federal court at all. It will be managed by the state court of California, because the 11th Amendment took away the federal jurisdiction that was intended in Article 1, Section 2. But you still read it in Article 1, Section 2, but that jurisdiction does no longer exist. So these are some of the problems that we deal with in the way we maintain the Constitution, because most people don't do the due diligence. But nevertheless, the whole point is to highlight this sophistry, this maniacal language, or I should say this sleight of hand, that Hamilton is using in the Federalist Papers to start tying an unlimited amount of things that the court should be involved in and logically should be involved in. And he points to how other jurist systems in Germany, Britain, and so forth, how this is how it's done. And we need to do it here. No. We have an enumerated constitution that specifies precisely what they can be involved in. You leave the door open and they can start accepting jurisdiction over anything and everything. You have an out-of-control court. You give general powers to your king. You give general powers to your legislature. And you will have an out-of-control government. And that's what we see today. We see in every state an out-of-control government. We see in the federal government an out-of-control government. We don't have, the powers granted to the states and the powers granted to the federal government do not create an out-of-control government. What's creating the out-of-control government is our failure to hold them accountable. That simple. So, let's go ahead and welcome back, Sean. And we left off with, let me see here. We were in the Federalist Paper number 80, and you just finished Federalist Paper
or I should say paragraph 9 of Federalist Paper 80. And so let's dive into 10. Again, because we're taking pauses and because there's so much in this, and the sophistry that Hamilton is deploying here, and the subtlety of how he's connecting the dots and then justifying them, is very alarming. But one has to think that the only reason he's doing this is he knows that the anti-federalists aren't seeing this and aren't responding. Because had anybody saw this, this would have caused the alarm for everybody. I don't know of anybody that has read these last 8 Federalist Papers in context of the fact that these were written in private and tucked into the back end of the Federalist Papers, of this document that has basically grown legs to become the monster that it is. So anyway, welcome back, Sean.
I'm good, sir.
Let's dive into 10, unless you got some comments or go-backs or anything like that.
No, sir.
All right.
Number 10, it may be esteemed the basis of the Union that the, quote, the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all the privileges and immunities of citizens of the several states, end quote. And if it be a just principle that every government ought to possess the means of executing its own provision by its own authority, it will follow that in order to the inviolable maintenance of that equality of privileges and immunities to which the citizens of the Union will be entitled, the national judiciary ought to preside in all cases in which one state or its citizens are opposed to another state or its citizens. To secure the full effect of so fundamental a provision against all evasion and subterfuge, it is necessary that its construction should be committed to that tribunal which, having no local attachments, will be likely to be impartial between the different states and their citizens, and which, owing its official existence to the Union, will never be likely to feel any bias inauspicious to the principles on which it was founded.
Okay, so anything jump out?
Yeah, as we go through this, it's just amazing how he just keeps on finding more arguments. Come on, give us the power. You need it for this. You need it for that.
So right in the very center of this is this, I've highlighted it. The national judiciary ought to preside in all cases in which one state or its citizens are opposed to another state or its citizens. In all cases. So what about divorce? When you've got a man, a wife has left him, she's traveled to another state, and he's pursuing divorce. What about property? Somebody stole your car, and they've traveled across state lines, and they're basically, trying to get that car back from some, their kid that stole their car, and now from the other state or what have you. Really? All cases. One would think that what he's saying is that the state justice systems cannot be trusted. That people cannot obtain justice from another state. It can only come from the federal government. He's literally, making this, in every possible way of being so wide open and so ambiguous that, there is no limit whatsoever to the jurisdiction of the federal courts. I'm surprised, and I would not be surprised, if there have been divorces that have gotten to the Supreme Court because they were so, drawn out, so big. I would not be surprised because there's nothing that they don't allow to filter up through appeals or what have you to them. Anyway, so 11, let's go with 11 here. A fifth point, yes.
The fifth point will demand little animadversion. The most bigoted idolaters of state authority have not thus far shown a disposition to deny the national judiciary the cognizances of maritime causes. These so generally depend on the laws of nations and so commonly affect the rights of foreigners that they fall within the considerations which are relative to the public peace. The most important part of them are, by the present Confederation, submitted to federal jurisdiction.
Okay, so that's in Article 1, Section, or Article 3, Section 2, that the Supreme Court shall have jurisdiction over all things arising under this Constitution and all maritime cases, admiralty cases, you know, things that are in direct relations to foreign law, laws of nations. Okay, so that's already there. I guess he just wants to... He, at this point, is just reminding us that, hey, they already have this jurisdiction, too. I'm waiting to see if he basically says that they should have jurisdiction over all common law. That hasn't happened yet. So let's go with number 12.
The reasonableness of the agency of the national courts in cases in which the state tribunals cannot be supposed to be impartial speaks for itself. No man ought certainly to be a judge in his own cause or in any cause in respect to which he has the least interest or bias. This principle has no inconsiderable weight in designating the federal courts as the proper tribunals for the determination of controversies between different states and their citizens. And it ought to have the same operation in regard to some cases between citizens of the same state. Claims to land under grants of different states founded upon adverse pretensions of boundary are of this description. The courts of neither of the granting states could be expected to be unbiased. The laws may have even prejudged the question and tied the courts down to decisions in favor of the grants of the state to which they belonged. And even where this had not been done, it would be natural that the judges, as men, should feel a strong predilection to the claims of their own government.
Okay, so, interestingly enough, and I think this is said by Madison in Federalist Paper 10, very similar comment, that no man ought to certainly be to be a judge in his own cause, or in any cause in respect to which he has the least interest or bias. So when we really look at the federal court is dealing with controversies between two bodies. Now, of course, in cases that arise under the Constitution, the bias would be baked in, and it would probably likely be the federal court would likely weigh in favor of the federal government, those things arising under the Constitution. But this actually begs the whole point that if the issue is not within their jurisdiction and the problem is with the federal government doing something they don't have the authority to do, then this one line stands out as an axiom. No man, no entity ought to certainly be a judge in their own cause, or in any cause in respect to which they have the least interest or bias. In other words, they're violating the Constitution. They can't be a judge. In other words, it would allow the court to create a defense and actually protect unconstitutional behavior, which is why Madison pointed out that when it comes to the matter of jurisdiction, if it doesn't arise under their jurisdiction, and it's a matter where the federal government is violating the Constitution, the only judge or the only tribunal that can actually hear the case to ultimately determine the true justice are the parties to the compact. Okay, so That's a green highlight right there. He's making a point right there that says they shouldn't be doing it, but he's still believing and pushing things through the rest of this paragraph that the courts need to be trusted. In other words, he creates the argument that everybody agrees with, but then he kind of undermines it by saying, well, and we need to trust the courts. No, they have bias, especially when they're hearing something that they don't, that doesn't arise under the Constitution, they don't, shouldn't have jurisdiction over, blah, 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 then, hey, they can't be judging. They can't. Even if they got it right, they shouldn't be sitting there. They should recuse themselves and say, we actually have, you know, interest in this as a party to the federal government. You know, because you have the three branches of government. That's the three parties of the federal government. And if the Congress is doing something, the president is doing something that they shouldn't be doing, and the states are saying, hey, you can't do this, it should not go into a federal court, period. It should go into a tribunal of the states, and then the states would ultimately decide what needs to be done. Okay, so 13, let's dive into this one.
Having thus laid down and discussed the principles which ought to regulate the Constitution of the federal judiciary, we proceed to test by these principles the particular powers of which, according to the plan of the convention, it is to be composed. It is to comprehend, quote, all cases of law and equity arising under the Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made, or which shall be made, under their authority, to all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and councils, to all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, to controversies to which the United States shall be a party, to controversies between two or more states, between a state and citizens of another state, between citizens of different states, between citizens of the same state claiming lands and grants of different states, and between a state or the citizens thereof and foreign state citizens and subjects, end quote. This constitutes the entire mass of the judicial authority of the Union. Let us now review it in detail, then. It is then to extend.
Okay. So right here, these following paragraphs is how he's going to justify the broader breadth of federal jurisdiction. So he starts off with the first one, all things arising under the Constitution. Let's see how he widens it this way. Go ahead.
First, to all cases in law and equity arising under the Constitution and laws of the United States. This corresponds with the two first classes of causes, which have been enumerated as proper for the jurisdiction of the United States. It has been asked what is meant by cases arising under the Constitution, in contradiction from those arising under the laws of the United States. The difference has been already explained. All the restrictions upon the authority of the state legislatures furnish examples of it. They are not, for instance, to emit paper money, but the interdiction results from the Constitution and will have no connection with any law of the United States. Should paper money notwithstanding be emitted, the controversy concerning it would be cases arising under the Constitution and not the laws of the United States. In the ordinary signification of the terms, this may serve as a sample of the whole.
Okay, so interestingly enough, he doesn't go down the path of clarifying those things arising under the Constitution between laws of the United States that, because he breaks it down here, the difference has already been explained. Let me see here. Cases arising under the Constitution in contradiction from those arising under the laws of the United States. So, in other words, can the United States government create laws that are only for the United States? In other words, the federal government. Federal laws that do not affect states. Can the federal government create laws that are enforceable but do not affect states and not enforceable in states? Yes.
I don't know. How could they do that?
Okay, so if you look at Article 1, Section 8, the exclusive legislation over the District of Columbia, they have the responsibility of policing their own land. They have the ability to create laws over military installations. And as we know, for the longest time, you've probably heard this, and it just came to news just in the past week or so, that on military installations, a person carrying a sidearm, not in uniform, is prohibited. In other words, the right to bear arms is prohibited on military installations and usually federal property. They've exerted the authority. They were the first ones to create laws that you could not smoke in federal buildings or in federal property. So they have this exclusive legislation over things that they have full cognizance over. The only things that they can create laws for, the states, are those things that are in pursuant to the granted powers, in other words, laws in pursuance to the Constitution and treaties under their authority. This is simplified in the ratification debates by Nicholas and Madison and others, where it literally is a derivative of a granted power. In other words, they can't create a treaty that would violate your rights to bear arms. Because it would be in contrast to the powers or the restrictions placed upon them. They can't create a law or a treaty regarding the regulation of, you know, land within a state to be regulated for the growing of trees or for the habitation of Indians. Those have not been granted to them. So they can't create treaties to do that. They can't assume that land either, because the land granted to them is identified in Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 17 as well. The only federal property that the federal government can possess as theirs as the United States is the District of Columbia and all forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and needful buildings for them to do their job. They have to have this land and property to do their job. There's no job for them on, you know, landscapes within a state because of a spotted owl, because wetlands and hopping fleas. If it's not enumerated, they cannot assume and possess any land. And the only land, like I said, I listed. So when they claim land, they're unconstitutionally claiming forests. They're unconstitutionally claiming wetlands or conservatory lands or parks or what have you. They have no authority. They cannot make law and enforce law on that. But more importantly, if they're going to create a law, the law has to be a derivative or a direct derivative of a power granted. Now, if an enumeration of the Constitution, such as all disabled people will have, you know, an entitlement and a right to access to all public and commerce and so forth, buildings and so forth, then they can create an act called the American Disabilities Act. But if that power is not delegated to them, then the ADA is not an act that can be applied to the states. It can only be applied to federal property, because it falls under the umbrella of exclusive legislation for the United States property. But for the states and the union, it has to be those things that are delegated under the Constitution. Did I confuse you on that?
No, sir. You actually clarified it.
Good. So to be clear, when Hamilton started making the case, because when he was writing this, he already had it in the back of his head, that as soon as this Constitution is ratified and he gets the ability to play political theatrics, he is going to introduce the concepts of implied powers and basically deviate away from direct derived powers. In other words, it has to be derived from the power granted, that they have the ability in the coining money. It has to also include to basically set up a bank to provide banking products, because that's what they were going to do in setting up the bank and creating banking products. They didn't need a bank, and it was pointed out they didn't need a bank, but Madison or Hamilton said it was implied. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so there's this little, I'll just call it this ledge. It's not a balcony. It's not an outcropping. It's just, you know, a part of the trim that exists in the Constitution called a territory. That the federal government is not, so if the federal government was to possess territories, it would be listed in Article 1 as a power to possess territories, go out and acquire territories for themselves. Then it would have been listed in Article 1, subsection 8, or Section 8, subsection 17, along with dockyard ships, arsenals, magazines. It would have been listed there as territories. But it's not. They set aside territories for a very specific purpose, and it's in Article 4, Section 3, for the admission of states. So when you read Section 3, it doesn't say that they have the power to possess and create and to obtain territories for themselves. What it does is it talks about the admission of states into the Union, that, and they create the criteria of what it would require for a state to join the Union, if it was coming out of a state, adjoining the states, what have you. It set the criteria in the very first paragraph. Nothing about the possession going out and obtaining territory. Nothing about that. So it's all about what the criteria is for a state to be admitted into the Union. Then, in the second part, to explain this answer with this explanation of this role and responsibility. So it is not a power, it is a role and responsibility for the federal government to admitting states into the Union. Ergo, if they're going to have the role and responsibility of admitting states into the Union, they're going to be the one that has cognizant control over the territory in preparing these states to join the Union. And in ancillary, or as an ancillary function or a perfunctory part of that responsibility, they have to make the needful rules and regulations of the territory while it is still a territory. But when that state steps into the Union, when they meet the threshold of joining the Union, then the delegates of the counties are to go form that constitution however they want to, as long as it's Republican in form, and that they create that state constitution and empower their government the way they want to. They have no, there's nowhere in Article 4, Section 3, where the federal government has any ability to influence the forming of the state, how it's going to form, and its own governing and anything like that. It clearly says that it has the power to dispose of and make needful rules and regulations of the territories of the United States. That's it. They cannot in any way or fashion control the governing, the forming of government, and, you know, the existence of states and their governments underneath them, the counties that create them. So most people think, oh, well, all states are territories. You know, they created this ambiguous, you know, where aren't we all a part of the United States? You know, the states are listed as a part of the United States of America. it was understood that the states themselves formed the Union, that the United States was a title for the general government, that it would be forming not a federation, but a quasi-limited, and they called it a general government, but they also referred to it as a federal, not a federation federal, but just a federal government with limited powers, just like they did under the Articles of Confederation. So the point is here, folks, is that even though there's this little thing out there that somebody may bring up, what about territories? Territories were not listed in the powers. It was not listed in Article 1, Section 8, under the legislative powers. It was listed as a role and responsibility that they had to nurture and develop all territories to basically bring them in as equal parties to the compact. In other words, it's like the child has the responsibility of babysitting the territories as they finally develop and become a new parent in the family. That they're to constantly add parents to the family. That's a role and responsibility for them. Not to rule them, but to be ruled and to support the parents. That's the whole job of the federal government. And it kind of seems weird, but it was brilliant because the containment or the way the powers were delegated, or I should say the way the roles and responsibilities and those things necessary for them to do those roles and responsibilities was brilliant. Because it kept them out from being able to manipulate states. And it didn't take long. 1816 was the day they started getting out of the bottle. You know, the little cap was, you know, there's a little gap in the cap. And the genie started coming out. And by 1820, that genie was out of the bottle, and they started dictating to states that you had to be slave states and you couldn't be slave states. And so forth and so on. So anyway, I apologize for digressing, but Hamilton is just kind of, you know, glazing over this so that it makes a confusion that all laws that come from the federal government are legitimate laws. Of course they're legitimate, but they're not legitimate across the board to states or to the federal government. So, I mean, you have to understand whether it's a United States law for United States property or if it is a constitutional law or a law that arises under the Constitution. Then it is applied to the states as well. So, anyway, sorry for belaboring that. Suffice it to say, let's go to the next one, 15.
Yeah, I had an issue I wanted to bring this up on... I ran across somebody because I was responding to some ridiculous post from the Democrats, and this guy tells me, it was about the the electoral vote pact, uh-huh. where they're going to give the electoral votes to the popular vote winner,
yeah, uh-huh.
which is completely unconstitutional. This guy tells me, oh, you know, it includes Republicans, right? Like, in other words, if the Republican wins the popular vote, they'll get it. So I should be happy, right? And he says, have you actually tried winning the votes of Americans instead of just territories? And I was like, territories? That strikes me as odd. But then when I went and did a little looking, the guy's from Australia. So I'm like, well, of course he doesn't understand that the states are independent, sovereign states. And, you know, other people or even Americans at this point think that somehow we've converted into this thing where the states are just administrative districts.
Yeah, so
it's ridiculous.
When you get in a conversation with somebody, citizen or not, regarding the choosing of the president, invite them to read Article 1 or Article 2, Section 1, and then read the 12th Amendment. And then ask Correct. Them... where we the people are involved in voting for, on a ballot, the president that's allowed under the Constitution.
Exactly.
In other words, where is it that we are supposed to go in to the voting booth and choose the president of the United States? Where is that in the Constitution? Because clearly the Constitution states that it is our electors that we choose, which creates the Electoral College, We vote for the electors, and the electors choose who the president's going to be, and they decide who will be the vice president. Case closed. Show me how we're following the Constitution currently, because right now the parties have full control over the Electoral College. And the Constitution doesn't allow that. And now we're going to migrate into a pure, properly popular vote? I'm sorry. We need to get back to the Constitution, not drift further from it. So I think that would be the best, because it shuts them up. Because, right. Well, we're already not following the Constitution. They don't know that. They don't even know that. And so all of a sudden, you've hit them with something they're not even prepared to deal with. And actually tell them, by the way, when you read the 12th Amendment, look at what it takes. If the Electoral College can't succeed, how many shots does the Electoral College have? I think it's two. Two. That's it. If they can't declare a clear, decisive winner, then it goes into delegations by the state legislators, by the states in Congress. In other words, each state gets one vote. So how does that have anything to do with a popular vote?
Nothing.
Because, and tell them that in 2020, had the 12th Amendment been exercised, Trump would have been reelected.
Right. And I'll just about to say that. My speculation is that's why we had the event we had on January 6th, was to prevent that from taking place.
Right. Okay, so let's move on.
Number 15.
Thank you.
It has also been asked, what need of the word equity? What equitable causes can grow out of the Constitution and laws of the United States? There is hardly a subject of litigation between individuals which may not involve those ingredients of fraud, accident, trust, or hardship, which would render the matter an object of equitable rather than of legal jurisdiction, as the distinction is known and established in several of the states. It is the peculiar province, for instance, of a court of equity to relieve against what are called hard bargains. These are contracts in which, though there may have been no direct fraud or deceit sufficient to invalidate them in court of law, yet there may have been some undue and unconscionable advantage taken of the necessities or misfortunes of one of the parties, which a court or of equity would not tolerate. In such cases where foreigners were concerned on either side, it would be impossible for the federal judicatories to do justice without an equitable as well as a legal jurisdiction. Agreements to convey lands claimed under the grants of different states may afford another example of the necessity of an equitable jurisdiction in the federal courts. This reasoning may not be so palpable in those states where the formal and technical distinction between law and equity is not maintained, as in this state, where it is exemplified by everyday practice.
Okay, so this is kind of interesting, because this, most people don't garner the deal of equity, because under common law, justice delivers an equitable outcome, an equitable justice. In other words, whatever you're out, that gets replaced. The justice system isn't to use punitive measures in hurting, you know, the bad guy. It is basically to ensure that the person harmed got what was due to them because they lost their property, what have you. And this goes back to that McDonald's case where, you know, the jury in a civil case, that's civil law, they used punishment to punish McDonald's $5 million for burning this poor lady's lamp who, you know, did this to herself. And so this is where our legal system has moved from an equity, a court of equity, to a court of civil law, where civil justice and or punitive measures in a financial category can be levied against a person. Because under common law, that's not, that doesn't play. Common law ensures justice. It doesn't ensure, you know, extra punitive measures. And what ends up happening, because we see this now, and it became common under the O.J. Simpson case, that you had the justice case where, you know, he was going to be, you know, sent to jail if he was found guilty for the rest of his life. That was the justice for the crime. But the family would then also be able to, had he, regardless of whether he was found guilty or not, the family had a civil law case that they could wage to, without having the burden of proving guilt or not, the fact that, you know, here's a guy that, you know, the facts lay out that he sure seemed like he was doing this, and that they wanted to financially punish him. Not just punish him for a crime, but now financially punish him. And so we've created, and we've become, because that kind of legal system, I'm going to venture to say, has everything, and it reeks of vengeance. Where there's, you know, when you really look at punishing, it's one thing to take a man and make him serve time. But it's another thing to take all the resources of that man and punish not just him, but his family. Who, you know, nine times out of ten, the family wasn't involved in the murder. They weren't involved. I mean, they had no idea, nine times out of ten. I mean, there is the corruption of blood, and the Constitution kind of deals with that. But bottom line, we had shifted because it aggrandizes more, it aggrandizes this paradigm of becoming a more vengeful society. Does that make sense?
Yeah, to a certain degree it does. But at the same time, I can understand where it was damages.
No. So
this person
equity,
that they...
I said equity covers that. So equity, right. Equity restores whatever you will have lost. It restores that.
Right.
Okay. But on top of that, a punitive...
But how do you restore a lost life?
Okay, so it's the whole point of restoring a lost life is a person serves the rest of their time in jail or execution. That is a crime that becomes a capital case. That's why it's a capital crime, where the person could lose...
Right, but that's not the same thing as the I'm not sure what the term would be, but the loss to the people as far as financial loss.
Okay, so I'm going to give you good
because their son may have helped provide for them in their older years or provided for, you know, in other ways and money that they put out towards his education.
Yeah, I'll give
and
you,
I know that sounds morbid.
I'll give you a really good case because capital cases were far more common with different crimes back in the framers' day under common law. Capital cases. In other words, not taking, you know, the land and property away from the family. They would just kill the guy for the crime that they committed because they figured it was that grievous. You know, and so this can kind of give you the purple nurple type of thing, right? You really go after somebody and be ruthless to say, you know, look, we used to actually kill people for stealing horses. That was a capital case. You stole a horse, boy, bam! And, you know, in consideration for the person that's paying that debt to restore that, because, you know, the horse is recovered, but they still hang the guy. But that was not a financial punitive thing. It was really, it was a moral thing. Just like adultery was the act of adultery. You were stoned. You were killed. It was a capital offense. Yeah. Okay. But that was a common law justice. That's the common law justice system. It is trying to ensure justice and making that's a good point. It creates deterrence of getting people to abide by the law. But using and decimating a person's finances to affect their family and a lot of other people, taking corporations from them, you know, where it affects jobs. I mean, that is a Roman law thing, civil law. That is,
right, I get that because okay. the injuries... Then you're injuring others through trying to make someone whole.
Yeah, or you know, it's kind of like, you know, when somebody punishes someone, you know, they get to a point where the punishment when you're, you know, whipping a, you know, child, or when you're using some capital punishment or something like that, where, you know, spanking, whips or what have you. The reason they actually came out with five lashes or what have you was because it became prevalent, or the problem became that the executioner, the person who was giving the whips, you know, wasn't satisfied. The satisfaction came at what they felt, you know, was necessary. And the sadistic, you know, character would take over, and next thing you know, they would actually start being very brutal. But anyway, you know, our legal system.
After a while, whip somebody every day, that's your job. After a while, you're going to lose your sensitivity to what you're actually doling out.
Yep. Anyway, so that's our legal system has, I don't want to say meandered, it has evolved. And the court system has been very active in evolving it to aggrandize more away from just a justice system, a system that was to deliver justice, to now, you know, delivering justice and vengeance. Now, we could go on and on, but let's keep moving here. What are we on, 16? Okay, so now he's actually leading this off with these subparagraphs. The judiciary authority of the union is to extend, and then boom, second, third, fourth, fifth, and so forth. So let's go.
The judiciary authority of the union is to extend, second, to treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, and to all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and consuls. These belong to the fourth class of the enumerated cases, as they have an evident connection with the preservation of national peace.
Okay, see what he did. See what he did there was he combined treaties with the ministers and councils, because when you look at the Constitution, go back and look at the Constitution, there is a semicolon that separates all, you know, the laws of the United States are actually, I can pull it up real quick because I can do that. I've, you know, readily pull it up. And there we go. And we'll go straight.
Yeah, I have it open.
Okay, so when we look at Article 3, Section 2, there's a semicolon after treaties and treaties made which shall be made under the authority, semicolon. Then it creates a new jurisdiction or an isolated jurisdiction. In addition to that, to all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and councils, semicolon. So in other words, if you look, these are actually separate jurisdictions. In other words, these treaties that are being made do not extend and are in equal to the jurisdiction over ministers and councils and other ambassadors and public ministers and councils. That's a completely separate jurisdiction. And right here, he combined them as they were, that semicolon didn't exist. I'm just nitpicking, folks, because one...
He wrote it like that for a reason.
He wrote it like that for a reason, because he's trying to use a sleight of hand. Okay, so go ahead, third.
Third, to cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction. These form altogether the fifth of the enumerated classes of causes proper for the cognizance of national courts. Fourth, to controversies to which the United States shall be a party. These constitute the third of those classes.
Okay.
Fifth, to controversies between two or more states, between a state and citizens of another state, between citizens of different states. These belong to the fourth of those classes and partake in some measure of the nature of the last. Sixth, to cases between the citizens of the same state claiming lands under grants of different states. These fall within the last class and are the only instances in which the proposed Constitution directly contemplates the cognizance of the disputes between the citizens of the same state.
Okay, so stop right there. Look at your Constitution and look at what he just listed. Claiming lands. This is all capitals. All capitals. And you'll notice that the Constitution does capitalize capital lands under capital grants of different states, capital states. That's it. There's not a full all caps. So in other words, this becomes more of an emphasis on a larger scheme, if that makes sense.
So Hamilton invented all caps.
Huh? Well, what he's doing is he's emphasizing. There's ways, and, you know, supposedly one of the more academic ways of emphasizing is italicizing the language.
Right.
But in this particular case, if you're trying to yell or emphasize loudly something, you capitalize. And so the Constitution and the Style Committee decided to actually, you know, capitalize the citizens between citizens of the same state, claiming lands under grants of different states, that way. But here's the thing. Again, all of these got annihilated by the 11th Amendment. But my point is that he's aggrandizing these things with caps to make it seem like there's even more there. Because I would think that some of these land grants or some of these cases might be very unique, where the federal government would have jurisdiction based on this current writing of the Constitution, where in others it wouldn't. And I'm, you know, I don't want to dive into it, but I'm just saying that I see when he's using caps that stand out differently from the Constitution, he did that for a reason.
It's for a reason.
It's for a reason, right. Seventh.
Seventh, to cases between a state and the citizens thereof and foreign states, citizens or subjects. These have been already explained to belong to the fourth of the enumerated classes and have been shown to be, in a peculiar manner, the proper subjects of the national judicature.
Okay, like legislature, but the judicial administrative body. Yep. Okay, so okay. 17.
From this review, the particular power of the federal judiciary, as marked out in the Constitution, it appears that they are conformable to the principles which ought to have governed the structure of that department and which were necessary to the perfection of the system. If some partial inconveniences should appear to be connected with the incorporation of any of them into the plan, it ought to be recollected that the national legislature will have ample authority to make such exceptions and to prescribe such regulations as will be calculated to obviate or remove these inconveniences. The possibility of particular mischiefs can never be viewed by a well-informed mind as a solid objection to a general principle, which is calculated to avoid general mischiefs and to obtain general advantages.
Okay. All right. So closing with that, again, there's some points in here where he's really provided, I'll call them balconies or planks, where, you know, you can wander well out beyond what the jurisdiction is, are connected the dots to say, hey, this should, all things concerning foreign citizens. Anyway, we're basically out of time. Any other comments?
No, sir.
All right. Well, one, I appreciate it. And Sean, I appreciate your diligence in pointing out all the details, because I would easily brush over these things. One of the things that, you know, I try to do is I try to look at the macro, you know, like with Washington and so forth, because I think everybody just had this awe for Washington. Washington could have easily maintained and died in office, and everybody was surprised that he didn't. And to me, that speaks of his character more, that he wasn't a spy than he was. But there's, you know, all of these things considered, folks. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.